This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Inna رَبَّكُمُ اللَّهُ الَّذِي خَلَقَ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضَ فِي سِتَّةِ أَيَّامٍ خَلَقَ السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش يغشي الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا ربكم تضرعا ادعوا ربكم تضرعا صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely, your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in six periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly, and He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely, His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely, He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The head of the UN nuclear watchdog says that an agreement between Iran and the agency is only a stopgap that would buy time for more diplomacy. North Korea says it has successfully tested a new long-range cruise missile hailed as a strategic weapon of great significance. U.S. President Joe Biden approved the disaster declaration for California over the recent wildfires in that state. It's good to have you with us. The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency says that the recent agreement between Iran and the agency solved the, quote, major communication breakdown with Tehran. Rafael Grossi said that the agreement would allow the IAEA inspectors to service its monitoring cameras at Iranian nuclear sites. He added that the agreement meant the agency had continuity of knowledge. He, however, added that the agreement was not a permanent solution and was only a stopgap that would buy time for more diplomacy.
Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, has made a day-long visit to Tehran. During his short visit, he met with the new head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami. The Iranian official hailed the constructive talks he held with the head of the IAEA, Rafael Grossi, in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Speaking at a joint press conference after the meeting, Islami described the negotiations, mainly on technical issues, as constructive and said confidence building is what matters for Tehran and the UN nuclear watchdog.
Today, Mr. Grossi came to Tehran at the invitation of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, and we had good and constructive talks. The negotiations were held in a spirit of cooperation to create opportunities for enhanced interactions within the framework of the International Atomic Energy Agency's rules and regulations. Mr. Grossi will visit Tehran again in the near future, and the IAEA's technical team will also come to Iran to make necessary arrangements for the replacement of surveillance camera memory cards in accordance with the safeguards agreement.
But I'm glad to say that today we were able to have a very concrete result, which has to do with the continuity of the operation of the agency's equipment here, which is indispensable for us to provide the necessary guarantees and the information to the IAEA and to the world that everything is in order and that we are going to be able to assist also to assist Iran in its future negotiations in the context of the JCPOA.
Back in February, Iran and the IAEA reached a technical understanding under which Tehran agreed to keep the camera recordings from its nuclear sites for 3 months as a goodwill gesture in support of diplomacy, waiting to see whether the other parties to the JCPOA could manage to bring the U.S. back into full compliance with the deal. The agreements came shortly after Iran decided to stop its voluntary implementation of the additional protocol that allowed the IAEA to carry out short-notice inspections in Iran, denying the agency's inspectors access to the country's nuclear facilities beyond the safeguards agreement. The decision was made in accordance with the December 2020 law passed by the Iranian parliament, dubbed a strategic action plan to counter sanctions that prompted the Iranian administration to restrict the IAEA's inspections and accelerate the development of the country's nuclear program beyond the limits set by the JCPOA. Iranian officials have cautioned the IAEA Board of Governors to avoid miscalculations at its upcoming meeting, warning that taking advantage of the IAEA for political purposes will draw a different response from Tehran. Saman Kujiri, Tehran.
Lavama Lizgi joined us a short while ago with some more details on the outcome of the IAEA chief's visit to Tehran.
And he described his trip as very constructive, saying that there was an immediate and urgent issue that needed to be addressed, and the good news is, as far as the agency is concerned, is that that issue has been, in his words, rectified, meaning that the agency can continue to have the knowledge and the data and information that it needs if it doesn't want there to be a gap in the continuity of knowledge. The Director General, in his latest reports, raised serious concerns about this, leading to speculations that the IAEA board would actually go ahead with a resolution against the country that would, in its turn, jeopardize the JCPOA resumption talks that have been halted for the time being. So it looks like now, you know, when Mr. Grossi was asked whether the developments in Iran mean that the agency would indeed decide not to go ahead with the resolution, whether the board will not go ahead with the resolution, Mr. Grossi said that he has already given this complementary information to the IAEA board to consider, and that he believes that with this additional information that the agency has provided to the board, this will, of course, influence the decision that the members of the board will make.
Now, Iran has slammed the West for what are called shameful double standard in dealing with nuclear-armed Israel. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh says the West has not only failed to put pressure on Israel to join the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, but it fully supported the regime. Khatibzadeh underlined that Iran would continue to push for the disarmament of Israel and a nuke-free West Asia. The spokesman noted that Israel, that's believed to be in possession of hundreds of nukes, is in no position to lecture about NPT members like Iran. Last week, Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid accused Iran of, quote, marching toward a nuclear weapon. Lapid said that Israel would act if the world failed to stop Iran. Iran has welcomed two naval vessels that have come back from a long mission to the northern end of the Atlantic Ocean. The mission marks Iran's first naval journey across far-flung areas. Yusuf Jalal reports from Bandar Abbas.
Iran's fully indigenous Sahand frigate and Makran floating base are back in the Persian Gulf after more than 4 months of sailing that took them as far as the northern end of the Atlantic Ocean, over a distance of 44,000 kilometers. The naval crew were warmly welcomed by senior military officials who feel proud that Iran's navy is now capable of sailing in the high sea for extended periods.
We passed through three oceans, the Indian Ocean, the South Atlantic, and North Atlantic Ocean. On the way, we passed through rough seas and finally arrived in Russia's St. Petersburg port. We then sailed all the way back home. All the mission took us some 4.5 months. This is the farthest point we have ever sailed to.
Sahand Frigate is a radar-evading vessel that's equipped with torpedo launchers and electronic warfare technologies. And Makran Floating Base is a support vessel that's fitted with a large helicopter pad. Sahand and Macron departed from the Persian Gulf in early May. The two ships passed by Cape of Good Hope, rounded Africa, and sailed through the North Atlantic Ocean to reach Russia, all without docking for refueling on the way.
Throughout our journey, we did not stop to refuel or recharge our medical or food supplies. We went straight to our destination. We had our support vessel Macron along with Sahand that refueled it along the way. It sends a strong message to our enemies, especially the U.S., which tried to play down our naval might.
Iran's defense sector has been under 4 decades of U.S.-led arms embargoes. Iranian officials say they have viewed the sanctions as an opportunity to gain self-sufficiency in the industry. Iran now claims that it has indigenized more than 80% of its arsenal, from drones and helicopters to warships and submarines.
The Iranian Navy is back from the longest voyage in its history. To Iran, sailing through the Atlantic Ocean was a game changer for 2 reasons. First, it shows that the country can rely on its domestically built equipment for tough naval missions amid U.S. arms embargoes. And most importantly, it adds Iran to the short list of countries with a blue water navy. Yusuf Jalali from the Persian Gulf.
North Korea has test launched a new type of long-range cruise missile, calling it a strategic weapon of great importance. The country's media reported the missile tests were carried out successfully on Saturday and Sunday. They flew 1,500 kilometers before hitting their targets and falling into the country's territorial waters. Pyongyang says the development of the missiles is an effective deterrence against hostile forces. The U.S. military reacted to the tests, saying they pose threats to North Korea's neighbors and beyond. Japan has also expressed concerns over the tests, saying it will continue to work closely with the U.S. and South Korea to monitor the situation. Talks aimed at dismantling Pyongyang's nuclear and ballistic missile programs in return for U.S. sanctions relief collapsed in 2019. A political analyst, Brian Berletic, says North Korea's missile tests are in response to threats from the United States.
The U.S. is depicting North Korea as a threat to the region. North Korea, since the end of the Korean War, hasn't invaded anyone and hasn't attacked anyone. Meanwhile, tens of thousands of U.S. troops are on its border. We have to remember that North Korea was, you know, trying to hold back during talks that it hoped would help relieve sanctions against it imposed by the U.S. And so I think the timing of this is related to the kind of the hopelessness that North Korea sees in dealing with the U.S. It feels threatened, is trying to demonstrate that it's capable of defending itself.
Now moving on, the United Nations is convening an aid conference for Afghanistan in Geneva on Monday as concerns mounting over a looming humanitarian crisis there. UN officials, including Secretary General Antonio Guterres and government representatives, are set to attend the event. The main goal of the meeting is to raise more than $600 million in aid for Afghanistan. The majority of the donated money will be given to the World Food Program and the World Health Organization to offer life-saving assistance to Afghan people. The Taliban's takeover of the country last month increased pressure on the UN agencies due to an abrupt suspension of foreign donations to the country. The world body says that more than 18 million Afghans are facing a humanitarian disaster, and millions of more could join them very soon. A Pakistani passenger plane has touched down at Kabul airport, becoming the first foreign commercial flight to arrive in the country since the Taliban's takeover. A journalist aboard a flight from Islamabad has been quoted saying that there was more staff than passengers on the aircraft. A spokesman for the Pakistani airline said that the flight will carry people holding valid travel documents from Kabul. The airport was severely damaged during the chaotic evacuation of more than 120,000 people that ended with the withdrawal of U.S. forces on the 30th of August. The Taliban have been trying to get it operated again with technical assistance from Qatar and some other nations. Qatar Airways operated several charter flights out of Kabul last week. An Afghan airline resumed domestic services on September the 3rd. The Yemeni army says its troops backed by local tribes have successfully liberated vast areas in Narib. Our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdul Latif Al-Washali, has more.
Yemen's armed forces, backed by local tribes, have successfully conducted the third phase of Operation Nasr al-Mubin. The spokesman of the Yemeni army, Yahya Sariya, said Mahliya and the Rahabat directorates of Marib, with an area of 1,200 square kilometers, were fully liberated. The spokesman also said over 150 mercenaries loyal to the Saudi-led coalition were killed or injured during the operation.
The Yemeni unit succeeded in fully liberating the districts of Mahliya and Al-Rahba during the third phase of Al-Nasr al-Mubin operation. During the operation, 151 mercenaries loyal to the Saudi-led coalition were killed or injured, and a total area of about 1,200 square kilometers were liberated.
Sariya also hailed the tribes of Marib for their role in supporting the Yemeni army in achieving the recent victory. Observers said the Yemeni army is now implementing the fourth phase of the Nasr al-Mubin operation, aimed at fully liberating all the occupied territories of Yemen.
The third phase of the al-Nasr al-Mubin operation was a strong and important stage for the Yemeni army, which managed to liberate 1,200 Yemeni lands from the mercenaries loyal to the Saudi-led coalition. Military operations are still ongoing, and there is a fourth phase through which the Yemeni army seeks to liberate all of the northern Yemeni lands from all forms of foreign presence.
For months now, the Yemeni army has been intensifying its military operations to liberate the oil-rich province of Marib from the Saudi-backed forces and terrorist groups. This move was considered as the first step forward to expel foreign forces from the rest of the country.
Yemeni tribes have repeatedly announced their opposition to the presence of any foreign forces, especially those of Saudi Arabia. People here believe that the military will not be able to liberate the country without the backing of tribesmen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says that fresh Israeli air raids on Gaza are an attempt by the Tel Aviv regime to divert attention from the successful escape of inmates from its high-security jail. Hamas' spokesman says that the response to Israeli air raids on Gaza and anger across the West Bank show the people's support for those languishing in Israeli prisons. The spokesman underlined that the regime has been unable to impose its will on the Palestinian nation. Earlier today, Israeli warplanes again pounded areas across the besieged Palestinian Strip. Israel claimed that the airstrikes are in response to rockets fired from Gaza. New tensions flared up after six Palestinians escaped the regime's Gilboa prison last week. Now, in other news, U.S. President Joe Biden has approved a disaster declaration for California as firefighters are battling the wildfire burning through the state for over a month. The White House says Biden has ordered federal assistance to supplement local recovery efforts in the areas affected by the fire. Biden will travel to the region on Monday to survey the damage. The Calder Fire is among scores of blazes burning west of the country during the summer. The blazes have been stoked by extremely hot, dry weather conditions that experts blame on climate change. It's led to five injuries and destroyed more than 1,000 structures. 65% of the fires are said to have been contained. In Brazil, hundreds of people have staged a protest in Sao Paulo against the president, demanding his impeachment. The protesters slammed Jair Bolsonaro's handling of the coronavirus pandemic. In the rally, Brazil's former health minister spoke against Bolsonaro's management of the outbreak in the country and called for his impeachment. Due to growing scandals, rising inflation, high unemployment, and the world's second worst COVID death toll, Bolsonaro's approval rating has sunk to record lows. The demonstration was held days after the country marked its Independence Day with rival pro- and anti-government rallies. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then fail to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
In the limelight.
Warm-blooded animals are changing beaks, legs, and ears to adapt to hotter climate and better regulate temperature. We now present you an article written by Helena Horton. The piece is titled "Research Finds Animals Shape-Shifting in Response to Climate Crisis." The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian.
Thank you.
Researchers have said animals are increasingly shape-shifting because of the climate crisis. The scientists found warm-blooded animals are changing their physiology to adapt to a hotter climate. This includes getting larger beaks, legs, and ears to better regulate their body temperature. When animals overheat, birds use their beaks and mammals use their ears to disperse the warmth. Some creatures in warmer climates have historically evolved to have larger beaks or ears to get rid of the heat more easily. These differences are becoming more pronounced as the climate warms. If animals fail to control their body temperature, they can overheat and die. Beaks, which are not covered by feathers and therefore not insulated, are a site of significant heat exchange, as are ears, tails, and legs in mammals if not covered by fur. The review, published in the journal Trends in Ecology and Evolution, found that the differences are particularly pronounced in birds. The author of the study, Sarah Riding of Deakin University, a bird researcher, said, "Shape-shifting does not mean that animals are coping with climate change and that all is fine." Sarah Riding said, "It just means they're evolving to survive it, but we're not sure what the other ecological consequences of these changes are, or indeed that all species are capable of changing and surviving." While the scientists say it is difficult to pinpoint climate breakdown as the sole cause of the shape-shifting, it is what the instances studies have in common across geographical regions and across a diverse array of species. Examples include several species of Australian parrot that have shown a 4 to 10% increase in bill size since 1871, positively correlated with the summer temperatures each year. Meanwhile, research on the North American dark-eyed juncos, a type of small songbird, showed a link between increased bill size and short-term temperature extremes in cold environments. Researchers have also reported tail length increases in wood mice and tail and leg size increases in musk shrews. Bats in warm climates were shown to have increased wing sizes. The paper argues that shape-shifting is likely to continue as the climate becomes warmer. It reads, "The increased temperatures associated with climate change are likely to influence, among other things, the thermoregulatory demands placed on animals." The paper says, "The increasing temperatures experienced as part of climate change may be selecting for larger appendages that facilitate efficient heat dissipation or result in relaxation of selection for small appendages, through which body heat could be deleteriously lost in cold climates." Though the changes are small, Sarah Riding said that could change as the planet becomes hotter. She says, "The increases in appendage sizes we see so far are quite small, less than 10%, so the changes are unlikely to be immediately noticeable," adding, "However, prominent appendages such as ears are predicted to increase, so we might end up with a live-action Dumbo in the not-so-distant future." Sir Riding intends to investigate shape-shifting in Australian birds firsthand. By three-dimensional scanning museum bird specimens from the past 100 years to see which birds are changing appendage size due to climate change. Sir Riding added, "A lot of the time when climate change is discussed in mainstream media, people are asking, can humans overcome this? Or what technology can solve this?" She added, "It's high time we recognize that animals also have to adapt to these changes, but this is occurring over a far shorter time scale than would have occurred through most of evolutionary time." She said, "The climate change that we have created is heaping a whole lot of pressure on them, and while some species will adapt, others will not. It is unclear whether these changes will affect the animals in other ways. For example, bigger bills could affect how birds feed, something that scientists plan to research in their future work." Moreover, according to a new report from the Arctic Council, a drastic drop in caribou and shorebird populations is a reflection of the dire changes unfolding under Arctic tundra. The terrestrial Arctic spans approximately 2.7 million square miles, that is 7 million square kilometers, marked by extreme cold, drought, strong winds, and seasonal darkness. Species living in this environment have adapted to thrive in the harsh conditions. But according to the State of the Arctic Terrestrial Biodiversity Report, published by the Council's Conservation of Arctic Flora and Fauna Working Group, the climate crisis has upended such survival strategies. The report says climate change is the overwhelming driver of change in terrestrial Arctic ecosystems, causing diverse, unpredictable, and significant impacts that are expected to intensify. The Arctic is warming at twice the rate of the rest of the world, leading to extreme weather events, southerly species moving northwards, and the emergence and spread of pathogens among native species. The report released recently at the Council's ministerial meeting in Reykjavik, Iceland, is the first to assess the status and trends for Arctic species living on land. Following the Council of Conservation of Arctic Flora and Fauna's 2017 assessment of marine biodiversity, the report drew on decades of circumpolar biodiversity monitoring to give an overview of the changes occurring in the region. It appears the Arctic is becoming greener and shrubs are gaining ground, slowly replacing mosses and lichens on the tundra. At Zakenberg Research Station in northeast Greenland, scientists found that important pollinating flies declined by 80% between 1996 and 2014, hinting at a climate-induced mismatch between the timing of plant flowering and pollinator flight activity.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
The subcontinent.
Welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. The program aims to discuss the most significant issues in the subcontinent that affect the governments, communities, organizations, and the region as a whole. And as usual, we will explore and explain its geopolitics, untangle the arguments from different perspectives, and make the alternative voices heard.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to take a look at America's Afghanistan debacle 20 years after the cataclysmic events of 9/11 that found expression in the so-called global war on terror. And we shall discuss why the US military-industrial complex decided to invade Afghanistan after the 9/11 attacks and what actually was on the agenda.
The military invasion of Afghanistan 20 years ago kick-started with the Pentagon carpet-bombing the landlocked country with B-52 heavy bombers and gunships. The disastrously misjudged response to the 9/11 attacks turned out to be nasty, brutish, and long. The so-called war on terror only bred more terrorism as successive regimes in Washington sought to conceal the truth. The futile military adventure that consumed millions of innocent lives finally ended with the way it started: suicide bombings and drone strikes in the heart of Kabul.
less than a month after four hijacked American planes crashed into landmark buildings in New York and Washington on September 11, 2001, killing 2,977 people, including 2,606 people at the Twin Towers and 125 at the Pentagon, then U.S. president led an invasion of Afghanistan, backed by an international coalition. The stated objective was to hunt down the alleged mastermind, the former CIA ally and Al-Qaeda founder Osama bin Laden, who was hosted by the Taliban. As the U.S. sent long-range B-52 Stratofortress strategic bombers, AC-130 Spectre gunships and MQ-9 Reaper drones to bomb the Tora Bora cave complex in eastern Afghanistan, where bin Laden was reported to be hiding, Barbara Lee was the only U.S. congresswoman to vote against authorizing what was to turn into America's longest war in history.
September 11th changed the world. Our deepest fears now haunt us. Yet I am convinced that military action will not prevent further acts of international terrorism against the United States.
Barbara was labeled a traitor by those who championed the 20-year military adventure that incurred an astronomically high cost, with innocent Afghan civilians bearing the brunt. The so-called war on terror over the years only spawned more terrorism while failing to achieve any of its stated objectives. 20 years down the line, the Taliban are back in power, Al-Qaeda still exists, while the Americans have been forced to pack up and leave.
It's way past time for Americans to question all of these interventions. Of course, you know, our press goes absolutely apoplectic, you know, crazy at the thought of some foreign government possibly trying to have some kind of interference in our elections, and here we are literally going around the world laying waste to one country after another. And I think the consequences of these interventions tell the whole story, truly. You know, over the course of the last 20 years, there are at least a million people dead, and I think that's far below the actual figure. Tens of millions of people have been displaced from their home. This has created all of these waves of refugees in these crises around the world. In addition, we have thousands of Americans dead, and we've spent all of these trillions, and that's just the money that we know of. I think that number also is probably quite low, but estimates have been $6 trillion. So we've been literally hemorrhaging resources and focus and money to these conflicts that have been disastrous one after another. And our own country is facing, you know, many serious issues, including a horrific deficit and debt. And we need to stop this hemorrhaging.
The Americans launched the invasion of Afghanistan on October 7, 2001, on the pretext of decimating the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and to capture the 9/11 mastermind Osama bin Laden. That was the stated objective. But the real agenda was more sinister: to militarily occupy the strategically located mineral-rich South Asian country. While the American public initially supported the idea of military action against the perpetrators of the 9/11 attacks, the support waned as the futile war dragged on, metamorphosing into a worst U.S. foreign policy disaster.
On the fateful afternoon of October 7, 2001, as the U.S. and allies started the three-week deadly bombing campaign in Afghanistan, dubbed the Operation Enduring Freedom, then U.S. President George Bush said the objective was to destroy Al-Qaeda, decimate the Taliban regime, and prevent the repeat of 9/11 attacks.
The Taliban regime is coming to an end.
The core objective was achieved in 3 months, but the Americans decided to continue the occupation. If eliminating Al-Qaeda and the Taliban or taking out Osama bin Laden were prime objectives of the military invasion, the US-led Allied troops would have called it quits long ago. But the aim was to occupy Afghanistan, strategically located between Central and South Asia. It was clear from the way the Bush administration snubbed Taliban's offer of truce to prevent bloodletting. Before the bombing campaign began, the group offered to hand over bin Laden to a third country for trial and even agreed to lay down arms and recognize the US-backed government in Kabul led by Hamid Karzai. The offers were spurned, leading to a misguided 20-year military adventure that ended in disaster.
This is in keeping with the policy of forever wars and never-ending wars. The purpose of the invasion of Afghanistan became, if it wasn't always the case, became a question of sustaining the various operations, the money-making operations that were going on there. So, you know, we see the same thing in Syria. I believe ISIS would have been completely defeated years ago, was it not for the U.S. illegal occupying troops there. So you don't want to get rid of the justification that you're using for the occupation that you're involved with. And, you know, this is how you keep wars going on for 20 years.
Even Americans woke up to the bitter reality years after rallying behind the war in Afghanistan. The worst U.S. military and strategic debacle not only failed to achieve its objectives, but laid bare America's global hegemonic project.
The key objective of invading Afghanistan immediately after the 9/11 attacks, as emphasized by Bush and his hawkish Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, was to, quote, find, stop, and defeat every terrorist group of global reach. The goal was practically unrealistic and unachievable. 20 years on, the threat of terrorism not only persists, but has assumed alarming proportions. Al-Qaeda is still around and thriving, while the Daesh militant group has mushroomed in Afghanistan under the shadow of US forces. That's how America's ominous presence breeds terrorism rather than annihilating it.
In the aftermath of 9/11 attacks, Americans vowed to crush every terrorist group of global reach, including Al-Qaeda. Bush famously declared on September 20, 2001, that the U.S. war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but does not end there. The impudence was clearly evident. Amidst the chaotic evacuation at Kabul's Hamid Karzai International Airport 2 weeks ago, a Daesh suicide bomber blew himself up, killing more than 200 people, including 13 U.S. Marines. The ghastly incident underscored not only the vulnerability of ordinary Afghans, but also the U.S. failure to eliminate the threat of terrorism in Afghanistan after a 20-year-long military campaign. It also blew the lid off U.S. military industrial complex's sinister interventionism in foreign lands. As reports later pointed out, the Kabul airport carnage also bore testimony to America's horrendous war crimes and impunity in Afghanistan. Many of those killed in the ensuing chaos at the airport didn't fall to the bombings, but to the indiscriminate firefight by American troops. More civilians perished later in the U.S. drone strikes. So, as some would argue, 20 years after the doomed military mission began, Osama bin Laden has won the war posthumously. American presence in the war-ravaged country, often described as the graveyard of empires, not only failed to wipe out terrorism, but bred it.
Hundreds of thousands of deaths there, millions dislocated from their homes, an increase in radicalization and terrorism, horrific corruption, including making Afghanistan the number one exporter of illicit drugs in the world. All of these things, you know, we've so-called achieved there, and we've spent trillions of dollars doing it. So everything that's been achieved, in my opinion, has been quite negative to the point of, I would say, evil.
The war in Afghanistan, launched by George Bush in 2001, remained an enigma for his successors. After invading the country and destroying it beyond recognition, Bush launched another costly military adventure in neighboring Iraq in 2003. His successor, Barack Obama, refocused on Afghanistan, killing bin Laden 10 years after the 9/11 attacks. He began a drawdown but stopped short of a complete withdrawal. Years later, Donald Trump signed a withdrawal deal with the Taliban, and his successor, Joe Biden, finally pulled the plug on America's longest war.
The chronology of U.S. military invasion of Afghanistan following the 9/11 attacks sheds light on failed strategy and botched mission that plunged the war-ravaged country into chaos and turmoil. On September 11, 2001, a 19-member al-Qaeda squad flew four U.S. airliners into the World Trade Center and Pentagon. A total of 2,977 people were killed. A week later, President Bush gave nod to military action. On October 7th, the bombing campaign began in Afghanistan under Operation Enduring Freedom. On April 17, 2002, after the Taliban regime was ousted, a transitional government was formed in Kabul. Between 2003 and 2008, Taliban regrouped even as the U.S. troop presence surged. In December 2009, Barack Obama raised the strength of U.S. forces to 100,000. On May 2, 2011, 9/11 mastermind Osama bin Laden was killed by U.S. forces in Pakistan, not in Afghanistan. A month later, Obama announced gradual withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan. In 2014, the U.S. NATO combat operations came to an end, although it never ended. The period between 2014 and 2019 was marked by uncertainty. On January 28, 2019, the U.S. and Taliban agreed on a framework for U.S. withdrawal. On February 29, 2020, the two sides reached a final deal. On January 15, 2021, U.S. troops in Afghanistan dropped to 2,500. On August 6, 2021, Taliban launched an offensive, laying siege to Kabul a week later. On August 30, 2021, the last remaining U.S. troops left Afghanistan.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. John Kirikau, journalist and former CIA counterterrorism officer. Before we begin, so glad to have you back on the program, Mr. Kirikau. Sir, the failed mission in Afghanistan caps off 20 years of refusing to acknowledge the limits of American power. Could you say the response to the 9/11 attacks was poorly planned and incompletely executed?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. I think that that the initial response, the initial U.S. Military response in Afghanistan was not poorly planned or incompletely executed. When you recall that the initial response was just to destroy al-Qaeda. We went into Afghanistan in October of 2001, and by December of 2001, al-Qaeda was destroyed. We should have declared victory at that point, and we should have have come home. Instead, we didn't. We made a terrible miscalculation, a terrible mistake in December of 2001 to remain in Afghanistan and to try to build the country into some sort of Western-style democracy. The Afghans did not ask us to do that. The American people had no idea that that's what the government intended to do. And instead, what it did is it practically bankrupted us as a country. It resulted in the loss of hundreds of thousands of lives, including thousands of Americans. And it was a terrible policy mistake.
Sir, do you think the whole misguided post-9/11 global war on terrorism, which found expression in futile military adventures in Afghanistan and Iraq, was an emotional overreaction?
I actually do think that the response in Afghanistan and Iraq was an emotional miscalculation. And on the one hand, I can actually understand and I think explain why we miscalculated in Afghanistan. Iraq is a little worse, but in Afghanistan, you know, this was such a major national trauma for us. The 9/11 attacks saw the deaths of 3,000 Americans, and so upwards of 95% of Americans wanted to attack Afghanistan, to kill Osama bin Laden, and to make the Taliban pay for their support for bin Laden and al-Qaeda. Iraq was a different story, though. Iraq was a deliberate effort by the neoconservatives who were in charge and power in the White House to just make war on a country whose politics we didn't like. When a country is invading another, when a country is occupying another, it doesn't matter who the head of that country is, its citizens are going to protect themselves and their families and their property. And that was something that neoconservatives at the White House didn't understand. They didn't fully appreciate. And as a result, we were bogged down in two wars that nearly bankrupted us over the course of 20 years.
Now let's take a break from the questions and take a look at how the global media has covered the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks in the backdrop of America's disastrous war and botched exit from Afghanistan.
What started as an operation to eradicate al-Qaeda has ended two decades later with the return of its Afghan enablers to power. Rarely have so many lives and so much cash been spent on so little. It would be nice to think that U.S. politics will learn from this debacle and both parties are complicit, but the story is far from over. America may have quit this forever war, but it will go on. There will be little time for postmortems as we come to grips with the implications of a rebooted Taliban. In his long war against America, Osama bin Laden has won a sweeping, if posthumous, victory. The U.S. reaction to the 9/11 attack he masterminded is like the cytokine storm that can occur when COVID-19 attacks us. The defensive measures our bodies mount go too far and damage the vital organs our antibodies were meant to protect. The 9/11 era began in Afghanistan, and now it has ended there in humiliating defeat.
Now, the American public initially rallied behind the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, but the support waned over time. Today, a vast majority of Americans have become critical of the U.S. foreign policy. So, what reasons would you attribute to it?
The issue is that literally nobody in the country thought that 20 years later we would still be involved in these countries. And so, over time, the vast majority of Americans began to oppose both wars, both Afghanistan and Iraq, to the point where now there's been something of a sea change in American politics, where people are far more isolationists now. We saw that with Donald Trump's presidency. People don't want to be involved in these entanglements overseas. And another problem is that, you know, we've made a lot of people very rich with our military budgets over the last 20 years. We spend more on the military in the United States than the next eight largest countries combined. If you're an American who's struggling to pay the electric bill or the gas bill or to put food on the table, or to put your children through school. And finally, after 20 years, people had enough.
So up to now, we've seen Taliban's stunning takeover, US's hasty withdrawal, the collapse of the Afghan government, and the new Afghan refugee crisis. So could you tell us, what does this tell about the American military interventions?
Yeah, the collapse of the Afghan government points to an intelligence failure, an analytic failure. President Biden said that the Afghan government could survive for 6 months. In fact, it survived for 6 days. He didn't make up that date. He was given that date by the CIA. The CIA got it wrong again. And I think the bottom line is that everything leading to the end of the U.S. presence in Afghanistan was a disaster. Now we have a hostile government in Kabul led by people who happen to be on the FBI's most wanted list, which is kind of funny and ironic. You've got a refugee crisis. You have American citizens who are stuck in Afghanistan and can't get out. What this tells us, I think, about American military interventions, and I apologize if I'm repeating myself, is that we never have a viable exit strategy. We don't know when the job is done, and we don't know when to declare victory and just go home. And we should have gone home 20 years ago.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Kiriakou for his precious time and insight. And as always, love to have you again on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media and cyberspace on 20 years since the 9/11 attacks and the Afghanistan debacle.
British journalist and broadcaster Piers Morgan says Biden's shameful Afghanistan disaster has made America look weak, spineless, and cowardly 20 years after the 9/11 attacks. George Papadopoulos, an American author and former Trump advisor, notes that Afghanistan will be run by the same group that was uprooted after 9/11, calling it intentional by Biden to humiliate the U.S. military. Afghan-American community organizer Halima Wali slammed the U.S. for tearing apart Afghanistan and blaming it for 9/11 when Osama bin Laden was found in Pakistan and the 9/11 hijackers were Saudi nationals. Arjun Sethi, a US-based lawyer and activist, says nothing will change the fact that Americans should never have invaded Afghanistan, stayed so long, withdrawn recklessly, and indulged in worse human rights abuses. American political scientist David Rothkopf argues that the response to 9/11 attacks was hijacked by opportunists with personal agendas that were ideological or industry-driven.
And that was our episode about America's misguided response to the 9/11 attacks and its humiliating defeat in Afghanistan after the 20-year-long disastrous military adventure. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
In the limelight.
In a new report authored by the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, it has been found that the federal government has spent $21 trillion on war and militarization both inside the U.S. and around the world over the past 20 years. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Lindsay Kashagarian Ryder. This article is published under the heading U.S. spent $21 trillion on war and militarization since 9/11. Stay tuned for more. 20 years have now passed since 9/11. The 20 years since those terrible attacks have been marked by endless wars, harsh immigration crackdowns, and expanded federal law enforcement powers that have cost Americans their privacy and targeted entire communities based on nothing more than race, religion, or ethnicity. Those policies have also come at a tremendous monetary cost and a dangerous neglect of domestic investment. In a new report authored by the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, it has been found that the federal government has spent $21 trillion on war and militarization both inside the U.S. and around the world over the past 20 years. That's roughly the size of the entire U.S. economy. Even while politicians have written blank checks for militarism year after year, they have said Americans can't afford to address the most urgent issues. No wonder these past 20 years have been rough on U.S. families and communities. After strong growth from 1970 to 2000,